Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Deng Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Wednesday, May 30th, 2018. As President Kiir flies to Addis Ababa to lobby against proposed sanctions, his spokesman accuses the U.S. of making the same old threats.
Each time the peace is about to start, the peace process is about to start, the United States of America issue a number of standing orders, you know, with regards to sanctioning.
And at least one expert says sanctions have a particular purpose.
My understanding of sanctions as a tool of engaging in international politics is that they're about influencing behavior and convincing actors to change the way they're doing things.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. One day before the UN Security Council votes on U.S. proposed sanctions against six South Sudanese officials accused of obstructing the peace process, President Salva Kiir left Juba for the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. He is there to lobby Ethiopian leaders to oppose more sanctions on South Sudan. Presidential spokesman Atenwe Keteny says Kiir will ask Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed Ali to use his position as head of IGAD to prevent U.S. proposed sanctions from moving forward. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba.
Keteny says President Kiir will try to assure Prime Minister Ahmed his government is committed to restoring peace in South Sudan.
He's going to give his view on how the government feels or the political will that the government of South Sudan has shown in regards to expediting, you know, peace process. So let's wait and see what will come out.
When Minister Kiir meets with Prime Minister Ahmed, he will argue that U.S. and U.N. sanctions could hinder efforts to restore peace in South Sudan, according to Keteny.
The gap is always widened by the fact that each time the peace is about to start, the peace process is about to start, the United States of America issue a number of standing orders, you know, in regards to sanctioning individuals within the government. So that one is translated by the rebels to be of their advantage, and they become more intransigent.
Ethiopia is one of three current African non-permanent members of the UN Security Council. Members are expected to vote on the U.S. proposed sanctions in New York tomorrow. Cuba-based political analyst James Okuk says it is likely Kiir wants Ethiopia to influence other council members.
Maybe it's time, maybe Kiir wants to lobby so that Ethiopia doesn't vote in favor of the sanction. And it might also use its influence as an African country to convince others not to vote, so that they don't get the 9 votes that are needed in the Security Council.
But Okuk says Mr. Kiir's lobbying efforts will only succeed if he assures the Ethiopian leader that he will make concessions on the contentious issues that prevented the warring parties from reaching a peace deal during the last round of talks.
He has to let go some of those positions and give it to the opposition. And if he does that, it means those who will go home or who will be changed from their position, they will not be happy. And that is the tough time he is in now. But if he doesn't make those concessions, it means there will not be peace in the country. So this is the dilemma we are in.
Okuk says it is up to the president to make the concessions that will appease the opposition parties so peace can be achieved in South Sudan. Okuk warns if Kiir does not offer serious concessions, South Sudanese leaders could face more sanctions in the near future. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Matthew Larici, assistant professor and director of the Global Leadership Center at Ohio University, says sanctioning leaders in South Sudan will not end the conflict in the country. Larici says the international community should instead provide the necessary tools for helping South Sudanese build their nation.
My understanding of sanctions as a tool of engaging in international politics is that they're about influencing behavior and convincing actors to change the way they're doing things. They're not meant to be, this is done not a judicial or punitive entity or idea. So certainly from the perspective of a lot of South Sudanese people, and certainly from a lot of others looking at it, that was the perception a lot of people had about these sanctions, especially the sanctions coming from the Security Council, and then later unilaterally from the Americans or other countries like Canada.
Let's talk about why they're not working, because a lot of actors in South Sudan have been sanctioned.
They've been sanctioning the same people over and over on a couple occasions as well. In the South Sudan case, you know, these sanctions are meant to support peace, right? That's the broad goal, supposedly. So everything we're talking about here, you know, this is about whether or not they're supporting, furthering a process towards peace. If we look at a string of sanctions going back to the first rounds, you know, we don't really see any change in the behavior of or the decision making of leaders. We see some of them having been promoted. We don't see any particular consequences coming from those sanctions. We've actually even seen a drop in the level of engagement and activity of international actors in terms of diplomacy and other activity. So there's also the concern that these sanctions may be, you know, a way for people to say they're continuing to do things, but, you know, not incur the costs.
There are some critics who are saying that this sanction regime is only targeting African countries, and they're not looking at some countries in the West who are doing business with countries that are unstable. For instance, there was a mention of Canada selling armored vehicles.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is one of the problems with the way these sanctions regimes are being designed and implemented. And so that's my big criticism of these, is the way it's being done. So there's a level of hypocrisy connected to this as well. This is both choosing which individuals they're sanctioning and also leaving out a lot of actors. So, you know, one of the cases I did mention was so the Canadian government sanctioned a number of South Sudanese figures following the Americans sanctioning them. But they haven't moved to deal with, you know, their own firms or others who, you know, they have jurisdiction over in terms of their role in the region. Even if it is limited, you still would expect that, you know, this would be done in a comprehensive way.
Let's look at the sanctions. What is the difference between sanctioning individuals and sanctioning a country?
Okay, so the reason there's been this move to targeting individuals and sanctioning individuals is that it became clear that sanctioning an entire country in many respects was actually punishing the civilians and oftentimes contributing to suffering for civilians for something that certainly, you know, they weren't responsible for. And if the goal is actually to improve the situation for the general public of a country, sanctioning the entire country was found to be counterproductive. So the innovation, at least as it was framed, was to target individuals. So they would find individuals and target those individuals. So I guess, and connected to that, however, is the problem that if you're targeting individuals who are leaders in a patronage society where resources are, you know, moved through some of those leaders, you do end up, you know, sanctioning larger groups. It's not specifically targeted.
That's Matthew LaReach, assistant professor and director of the Global Leadership Center at Ohio University. He was speaking with my colleague, John Tanza, from Ohio earlier today. British charity Oxfam is calling for urgent action to prevent famine in South Sudan this year. The call follows a recent report from the Famine Early Warning Systems Network, or FuseNet, which said a fifth of households in Boma State's Pabor County could already be categorized as reaching famine levels of hunger. Waki Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
Oxfam says thousands of people in Pibor and other parts of the country are facing severe food insecurity, with many now resorting to eating grass and wheat to survive. An Oxfam official says some of those people have fallen ill. Tim Bailey, Oxfam's campaign manager in South Sudan, says poor harvest and rising food prices have contributed to widespread hunger.
Like the rest of the country, people has been hit by the conflict over the previous 4 years up to now, and it's also suffered a huge number of shocks throughout that time, including loss of cattle raiding, huge displacement, environmental shocks like flooding, which wiped out whole crops last year, and also cattle disease as well. There are reports that up to 10,000 cows were killed by disease in 2017.
Bailey says the people of Boma State have also become food insecure after pests and floods destroyed their harvest. And Bailey says violent cattle raids from armed men in neighboring states have not helped the situation. As the rainy season sets in, much of the food people depend on has to be flown in from Juba, making it unaffordable for many, according to Oxfam. Gatwich Peter Kulang, Undersecretary in South Sudan's Humanitarian Affairs and Disaster Preparedness Ministry, admits many people, residents and people in neighboring areas have nothing to eat.
We know all about all those things, not only people, even in the area of Jonglei. Most of the areas, about nine areas, or more than nine areas now are affected with the current rain in the areas of Jonglei. We have received also information from the National Civil Defense Services and also other departments within the government.
The latest Integrated Food Security Phase Classification report says 7.1 million people across South Sudan are severely food insecure. Bailey is urging donors to step up before the situation worsens.
The international community cannot wait for a famine declaration before acting, before providing much needed support to South Sudan.
The United Nations declared a famine in Leer and Mayendit areas of former Unity State in 2017. A massive aid effort helped save lives and avert an even greater crisis. But with last year's poor harvest and this year's harvest not due at least until July, Oxfam says South Sudan is facing a catastrophe once again. The charity says aid efforts have so far kept famine at bay, but the need is growing at such an alarming rate that aid organizations are struggling to keep up. Bailey says Oxfam is seeing similarly worrying trends across the country, especially in Kapoita State and in Nyerol County of Eastern Bia State.
So far in 2018, the humanitarian response plan is only 22% funded, and we're nearly halfway through the year. Clearly, donors must prioritize South Sudan and its people. We also really call on the international community and the region around South Sudan to redouble attempts to bring peace talks to fruition and to bring peace to South Sudan.
Oxfam's call for the urgent action comes just days after the IGAD-mediated peace talks ended in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa without a peace agreement. Oxfam warns that if the fighting continues, more people will be forced to flee their homes, which means more people will be unable to make a living and more people going hungry. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
A former Ebola patient in the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo has been cured of the illness and released from the hospital. Wangui Nondi's release comes about 2 weeks after he was admitted to a hospital in Bikoro in Equator Province. The aid group Doctors Without Borders says it has started vaccinating frontline workers in the area, as well as those who have come in contact with infected patients. Doctors Without Borders says this strategy will help build a ring or buffer to block the spread of Ebola. Doctors Without Borders has set up two treatment centers in Bikoro where there are at least 10 confirmed patients and a dozen others suspected to have the illness. The aid group is also working in the remote areas of Itopo and Iboko. Those suspected of infection by Ebola are kept in isolation in Itopo. An isolation area and treatment center are also being established in Iboko.
¶¶
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Sudanese migrants in Paris are facing a tough road ahead. Find out more when we return.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what's the most important value that your parents taught you?
They taught me to respect everyone. This makes me to live well with any person.
How to live together with people and how to prepare myself for the future. For example, I was taught how to cook by my grandmother. So I stayed with my grandmother and he taught me how to cook. So it has helped me because I don't always stay with my family. So that's the most important value my parents have taught me.
Being someone who might be honest in my life, even in our daily life, it's very important anyway, because in these days many people may not be honest because of their interests.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. French police evacuated approximately 1,000 migrants this morning from the largest of three makeshift migrant camps in northern Paris. The camp, known as the Millenaire or Millennium Camp, was home to mostly Sudanese, Somali, and Eritrean migrants. Reporter Catherine Field spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the process of moving the migrants and how a new immigration law could affect the future of migrants in Paris.
Yes, it was at dawn that security forces came through the camp that's become known as the Millennium Camp, which is in the northeast of Paris. It's essentially a shanty town of tents, of lean-tos underneath the overpasses, the bridges in the northeast of Paris and alongside the canal. It's where there have been some 1,500 migrants living there in tents. Most of the migrants there have come from Sudan, Somalia, or Eritrea and have arrived in France from Italy before that they had crossed from Libya across the Mediterranean. French authorities have moved them to different sites across the Paris region. Some have been taken to gymnasiums, others to school halls where beds have been made available for them. In the course of Wednesday, their IDs will be checked, their immigration status will be checked. And then between now and the end of this week, their papers will be gone through. The authorities will be looking to see who qualifies to apply for refugee status or asylum status. And also, they will be checking thoroughly to see if any of those who have been taken in today have already registered in other European countries. The French authorities say they will be sent back immediately to those other countries where they have initially applied for either refugee or asylum status.
And so far, I guess about 1,000 have already been moved, and there's still more to be moved.
Yes, they've moved around 900 men, 11 unaccompanied minors, and 87 women and children. There's still at least another 1,000 who will be moved sometime within the next week. They are being left where they are for now because this whole process just takes so many security forces and it also takes so many bureaucrats to go through the paperwork. The other two camps are further towards the center of Paris along the canal. There are several hundred migrants from Afghanistan. They are said to have come from Germany, Sweden, and Austria, where they had originally applied for refugee status. They will be moved sometime within the next week. It really does show that, once again, the Paris authorities have been unable to cope with these arrivals. There's been this big argument between the Paris town hall and the central government over who is responsible for these migrants. The Paris town hall says it's the state, and the state is saying, look, you've allowed these camps to spring up in Paris, you've actually got to look after it. Certainly, from the state's point of view, this is the 35th evacuation that they've done in the last 3 years. These evacuations are becoming bigger and, of course, more frequent. And they say that if the Paris authorities hadn't moved these people on very quickly, then this is what's going to happen again and again and again. On the other side, though, the NGOs and the Paris town hall are saying, look, unless there is a system across France of sort of special free reception centers, then these migrants are going to keep coming back and they're going to look for anywhere that they can pitch their tent.
What is President Macron saying about the situation at this point?
President Macron has got his eye very clearly on this new migration law that is now going through the upper house of parliament. It's been through the lower house already. And his new law will speed up the asylum process, but it will also increase the deportations. What he's clearly saying is that if you have a right to refugee or asylum status in France, we're going to get your paperwork done quicker because of this new law once it goes through parliament. Likewise, if you're only here for a job, looking for an economic benefit, then you're going to be home again much quicker than before.
That was Catherine Field speaking with VOA's Kim Lewis from Paris. Zimbabwe's president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, has set July 30th as election day. But as Sebastian Mofu reports for VOA from Harare, there is no joy for Zimbabweans living outside the Southern African nation, as they will not be allowed to vote in those polls.
In a government gazette Wednesday, President Emmerson Mnangagwa said July 3rd as the day Zimbabweans will choose their next president as well as members of parliament and city councils. September 8th is when a presidential runoff will be held in the event that there is no clear winner in the first round. However, Zimbabwe's highest court has ruled that Zimbabweans who do not live in the country cannot take part in the elections. On Wednesday, the Constitutional Court dismissed a challenge to electoral laws which prevent Zimbabweans in the diaspora from taking part in their country's electoral processes. Belinda Chinowawa of the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights Group said she made the application for some non-resident citizens. They had hoped that Zimbabwe would join other African countries like Ghana, Mozambique and South Africa in allowing their diaspora citizens to vote from the countries where they live.
Well, we're naturally very disappointed because we really did believe that there is now a constitutional right to vote for all Zimbabweans, whether they're based in Zimbabwe or they're working from abroad.
What made you think that things would change now in the past, the courts have been turning down your application?
Well, because now we have, in terms of Section 67 of the Constitution, we have political rights, and these include the right to vote for all Zimbabwean citizens over the age of 18. So we believe that as long as our clients were not convicted of any electoral offences, we believe that they firmly had a right to vote and that their residents in other countries should not have denied them that right.
Over the years, millions of Zimbabweans, by some estimates a third of the population, have fled Zimbabwe due to a failing economy and human rights abuses by the government of former President Robert Mugabe, who resigned under pressure from the military last November. The government argued it did not have the money to conduct elections throughout the world. Tawanda Kanengoni, the lawyer for the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission, spoke after the court's ruling Wednesday.
The position that had been taken by the commission was that it would abide by the decision that would be made by the court. A decision has been handed down and the commission will act accordingly.
The Electoral Commission must now prepare for the polls. President Mnangagwa will face a challenge by Nelson Chamisa of the country's main opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Kenyan Youth Affairs Principal Secretary Lillian Amolo, who has been charged in the massive corruption case at the National Youth Service, was admitted to a hospital today after falling ill in prison. Amolo reportedly complained of dizziness and was trembling, but no details on her condition have been released. Amolo is among 24 government officials and business people arrested yesterday. Earlier today, they appeared in court and entered pleas of not guilty. The court ordered all of them to remain jailed until a bail hearing is held on June 4th. Prosecutors also have charged about two dozen other people, but they have not yet been arrested. Kenyan farmers are changing their crops to adapt to climate change and droughts. With the support of United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, more Kenyan farmers are switching from corn to sorghum and seeing better results in terms of nutrition and income. Barack Akoba, FAO project manager in Kenya, spoke with Ricky Schrock about the benefits of sorghum.
Most farmers are moving from growing of corn to sorghum. And this is only for the farmers who are in semi-arid areas, not across the whole country. And they are doing this because it is drought tolerant. That is, sorghum is drought tolerant. But besides that, it is fetching better money because they are focusing on sorghum that can be used by the breweries for making beer.
Besides being drought resistant, has this had any other effect on the local population in terms of food availability? Is sorghum more nutrient rich as well?
Yeah, it is. Definitely sorghum has better nutrition than maize. Besides being drought tolerant, the nutrition is good. It can be stored longer than maize. Farmers can mix it. Sometimes they make other products out of the sorghum. For example, for baking, their local cake, they can mix it with other beverages and it makes a more nutritious meal for them. So the switching to maize, you know, as you know, maize requires a lot of input in terms of nutrients, especially in the semi-arid areas where the rainfall is very low. And for that reason, they prefer to have sorghum because of the two or three reasons I've given in terms of drought tolerance, higher nutrition.
And another interesting thing, I think, is that sorghum is actually, of course, native to this area of East Africa, while corn is not. How did corn get there in the first place?
I think, as you know, it's corn, it is sources Southern America. It was introduced here by the British during the colonization, and it has become almost the food. In fact, when you ask most Kenyans, they will tell you food is corn, you know, or maize flour. But because of increasing competition for that and the climate change, the same grain or crop cannot grow everywhere. Farmers are now changing to diversify to other crops.
And is there any resistance to changing the diet?
Of course, if you can only resist if you have alternatives. But in the face of food scarcity, increasing population, people are looking for alternatives. And with education, an organization like FAO have put in effort to train farmers on food diversity, making sure they meet their nutrition security. Farmers are changing, and especially the urban population is changing drastically.
That was Barack Akoba, project manager with the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. He was speaking with Ricky Schrock from Nairobi. Street beats, go get 'em. And that's our show for this Wednesday. We leave you with the song Zero to Hero, performed by Idem featuring Akwaboa. Go get 'em. I see them breezes on my feet. But I go dance to the rhythm of the beat. Yeah. I know, say sometimes I fall on my knees. Dance to Teddy and Ponyan Coupon. Go give me some peace. I can't be me feeling in the amount. Energy was too, I'm on the amount. Still Teddy and Posato, so could I move? I go give you thanks and praise. Yeah, me feeling in the amount. Energy was too, I'm on the amount. Still Teddy and Posato, so could I move? I go give you thanks and praise. My way is over. And it's off my shoulders. Now I'm moving higher. And I'm moving, I'm moving. And I'm moving, I'm moving. I'm moving from zero to hero. Wow, wow. Zero to hero. Yeah, zero to hero. Wow, wow. Zero to hero. And I'm moving from zero. Go get him. 2G6, Sadegale, Gale, and 2G. We've been listening to Idim featuring Akwaboah with the song Zero to Hero. I'm Ayen Deng Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening. We hope you join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America. I'm a journey, my dream as a bandage. A shot, I don't go make a good die. Zero to hero, slow down the rise. Straight beat. Now my waist is over. I'm sweeping from the sun. And it's off my shoulder. I'm sweeping from the sun. Now I'm moving higher. And I'm moving, I'm moving.